The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Brad Stokes, and with me today is my guest, Peter Merrill from Xscale. Peter, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm very long-winded, so I'm going to try hard not to be. I was a developer for most of my career. I never really thought I was going to be an Agile anything. It wasn't what I was planning to do. For 30 years, I just delivered software, and I was very happy doing that. In the 90s, I got involved in early days of XP, and I wound up running the second XP program in the world when I was living in San Diego. That got me credit in Beck's first book. And from that point on, I wasn't doing anything that was intended to advance the culture. I was just trying to get the nonsense out of the way. And I saw Agile, or Extreme in those days, as a way of doing that. So I wound up inventing the first Agile training game. I spoke at the first Agile conference, which was XP2K, about 6 months before the manifesto. And I ran that game for the plenary there. But I was never trying to be any kind of a boffin. One of my sessions got turned into a chapter of the third XP book. But it was... Oh, it was 2007, 2008, before I started selling myself as even an Agile coach. As far as I was concerned, I was just interested in delivery, and this got the nonsense out. So what happened was I was program manager and architect for Reuters' first Agile program, and it was very hard yards. It was a 9-month runway for an absolutely mission critical E2E trade compliance portal, deadline put in place by the EU Parliament, and got there, and got, had a call about 6 months later from Chris Murphy at ThoughtWorks Australia, and he said, "We've got something difficult, something risky to do, and would you do it?" And I said, "Why do you want me to? I don't understand. I do delivery. I'm not, you know." And he said, "Well, okay, so this is not delivery. This is coaching a transformation for the BI group at AMP, which is Australia's, for people who don't know, Australia's second largest or largest insurer, one of those. Anyway, and I said, "Well, that's your meat and potatoes." And he said, "Yeah, but it's risky. And you just did this Reuters thing, and we were asked to do that, and we thought it was too risky. We turned it down. So we thought, you know, we'll try subcontracting this one to you." So, well, it worked. And then that led to me going into IAG, nothing to do with ThoughtWorks, just off my own bat. And I ran a transformation there for a group of 330. That was 2010. Mm-hmm. And then I got invited back into CBA to be strategist and principal coach for the transformation there, 2011, started 2012. Now, CBA had fired me for doing Agile in 2005. So to cut a long story short, 3 years later, I wound up on stage with Michael Hart, and he was group CIO, and he declared Agile as one of the five pillars of this bank's future and had me talk for 10 minutes. So I thought, all right, I think I've learned something. I need to bring this thing back to the culture somehow. And so I tried just sort of waving the flag, and I discovered that there was this gigantic marketing department for many, many gigantic marketing departments, and no one would hear a little Australian guy waving a flag. So I thought, well, I'll brand it, and that didn't help very much. I mean, my direct consulting clients were getting it. But it was 2016 when I went, okay, I'm going about this wrong. There is now this behemoth squatting on what was formerly a nice open learning ecosystem, and I need to disrupt them. So I'm going to rebrand this as the Linux of the Agile world. And we got traction, and we've been growing ever since. And now we've got about 120 coaches worldwide involved, all across the Americas, EU, UK, Australasia, of course, India. And we're making some small inroads into Asia at the moment.
So this is part of our Gamer Framework series. You apparently had a couple of your coaches contact you and say, hey, why not us? So you're doing, your system is called XGAL. Now, I said system rather than framework because I believe you don't refer to yourself as a framework. You refer to yourself as a tool set. I think you've said those exact words to me at one point. Yeah. For our listeners, what is XGAL?
Well, you could think of it as the word scale with a great big X through it. But let me go to the framework thing first. Well, so you could use XGAL as a framework. And Gartner write us up in their market guide to enterprise agile frameworks. And they've done that for the last 3 years. They're doing it again this year. I'm not going to object to Gartner writing us up. There are people who just want to use XGAL, and good on them. But our idea is that a framework is basically two things. It's a pattern language in the Alexander sense of pattern, and a cult. We don't want to do the cult thing. So I like to call it an ecosystem, because we define an ecosystem as a network of mutual benefit. And our idea is that we're just trying to benefit the clients. We're not a certificate mill.
So cult is very strong language.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, people have started talking about the emperor's new clothes in connection with Agile. There's a lot of people who are just out there calling themselves all kinds of grand panjandrum titles. I saw a lady I happen to know, and I'm not naming any names, who a year ago was a beginner scrum master, and now she's calling herself what does she call herself? Was a transformation coach. What does that mean? So I think if you look at it, we've got, between SAFe and Scrum, we've got billions of dollars worth of certificates that have been sold. And do these certificates actually mean a damn thing? You know, if I see someone's got a bunch of certificates after their name, I just go, L plates, learner's permit is what they've got. What I'm interested in doing is bringing together a bunch of independents in the same sense that the Linux community works, and going, all right, well, we're going to work on the same stuff. We have the same approach to what we're doing. And our approach is about descaling. We think scale is the problem, not the solution. So if scale is a problem.
I was just thinking that the descaling one's an interesting one, because it does get brought up within the wider Agile community. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by descaling? Because it does mean, like, scaling we know is we've got one thing and we make it two things, and then we make it four, and then we make it eight. So we're getting exponentially larger.
Yeah.
What is for you the opposite of that? Is how do you descale? What is descaling to you? Let's start with that.
Well, we should probably start with how we measure it. You know, if you don't have what numbers, then it's all bullshit anyway. So there are basically three metrics, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry, am I allowed to say?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Okay.
We come with a language warning.
All right. So the deal is, it's not good to have a lot of people in the room. If you're going to have a self-organizing team, you probably want to have something that's six people, not five, not seven, six, because six is three pairs and two triples. Factors better. So that seems to be the sweet spot for self-organization. Maybe you want to do a scrum and have a seventh. I read that Sullivan's been saying that he thinks
five
is ideal now, yeah. but I don't know where he gets that from. All of the data I've gotten, we've got some, says six, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, those are ideals. Anyway, so the maximum meeting size that you have to have in your organization to make any decision in your organization, what is that? Because if you've got these little teams of five or six or seven, But to make a decision, you need to have 250 people in a room. That's not very good. It would be really good if the biggest meeting you needed to have to make a decision was six. That would be a good metric. Another one, the distance between the doers and the deciders. Now, we started calling this the delegation collaboration ratio, because that sounds very grand. It's got a three-letter acronym that goes with it. What's the ratio of decisions that are made on average across your organization that are made in the team that's doing it versus that are made by someone that they've delegated to? As far as we can see, if that ratio is in the hundreds or the thousands, because they say you've got six people on a little team and most of the decisions that are being made for them elsewhere, that would be in the hundreds or the thousands. That would be something where you've got strict hierarchical delegation. We've got some techniques that bring it down to one-to-one, and actually most of the decisions wind up being face-to-face. And a lot of those techniques we get from places that are pretty far outside of traditional agile culture. In particular, we derive a lot of inspiration from permaculture, which is an Australian movement that's gone global since the 70s, and from First Nations peoples, in particular, the Haudenosaunee, who the Europeans call the Iroquois. So they were a North American civilized, oh, they still are, but they were a political power in North America for five centuries. And they wrote their code down as the Great Law of Peace, or just the Great Peace, I think is what they usually call it. So we get stuff from them. But getting back to descaling. So then the third one is, how fast are your feedback loops? You know, we've got in DevOps Amplify feedback loops. If your feedback loops are very ample, but they take 3 months before you get any feedback, that's not very good. We think cadences should basically be daily and or weekly. And anything that's longer than weekly is very suspect. So Scrum Guide says you can have 3 or 4 week sprints or whatever the heck it is. That's never worked. If we can think about things that are happening on a daily or a weekly basis, we're talking about realities that are hitting us in the face. The moment you even go out to 2 weeks, there's decisions being deferred because, oh, we haven't got around to that meeting yet. And a lot of the reason you haven't got around to that meeting is because the meetings are long and involve a lot of people. So the more that we descale, the more we can adapt. But of course, the problem then is you have to keep people aligned. It's not enough to just say, oh, you've got these little autonomous squads. And so that's where we've got set of patterns we call leadership as a service, and another set we call the game without thrones.
Oh, you've got I see that reference in an upcoming event that you have as well.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I'm long-winded, so I'm worried that I'm not letting you get a word in.
That's no problem. Okay, so we've talked about descaling. Xscale, it's not a framework, but can be. Mm-hmm. More of an ecosystem sort of thinking.
Well, let's say that on the material end, this is a pattern language, and the advantage there is you can combine these patterns with all of the frameworks. You don't need to say, oh, we're doing Xscale, we're not doing Safe. No, we can do Safe and Xscale. We can do Safe and Xscale and Spotify. And you might go, wait a second, Safe and Spotify don't seem to be very similar. But actually, once you take the command and control out of it, once you apply this leadership as a service protocol, there's no reason you can't combine these things. It works very nicely.
Okay, so this is actually quite interesting. So a pattern language. So you're talking about, if I was in design, for instance, a pattern language would be components that I could use in multiple places, but it would mean that I have some consistency.
Yeah.
Not uniformity, but some consistency depending on the components I choose throughout the different bits of the organization, or organizations, plural, is that kind of where we're going with this?
There is a guy named Chris Alexander. And Alexander was an architect of buildings and suburbs and houses and things. And in the 80s, he produced a book called A Pattern Language to try and transmit the stuff that had worked for him. In the 90s, the software community picked this up and there was a patterns movement. Most people, from that era, remember the Gang of Four book, which was the most popular software engineering book of its era, which was called Design Patterns, I think was the official name. And the patterns movement was really instrumental in forming the first blush of Agile. I mean, XP started on the Portland Pattern Repository. I was one of 12 stewards there. I mean patterns in the sense of well-proven solutions to commonplace problems in specific contexts. So to that extent, if you think of those as components, yeah, it's a fair metaphor for them.
Oh, I was just going to my UI stuff that occasionally happens. But yes, also the patterns. So they're like you just said really nicely, well-proven ideas. So how does a person who would be approaching this for the first time look at Xscale? How would you suggest that they approach the body of work that is Xscale, the pattern behavior, all that sort of thing?
That's a really good question. But my answer depends an awful lot on the person who's approaching us.
Nice.
So the idea that there's some big picture diagram and you start here and you follow this track and you get your suit off the rack and so on, to us, that's a bit silly. There is an answer because we want to make it easy for people. It's not a matter of, oh, gee, now you're going to be climbing the Himalayas and you're going to have to figure your route up K2. The idea is that we want to apply the original XP principle of Yagni. You aren't going
to need it. Yep.
Yeah. So you've got a problem to solve. That's where we start. So what kind of a problem is it?
So let's put on a few different hats.
Yeah, but
I'm in an existing implementation of Scrum.
Yep.
I'm a Scrum Master. I've got some dysfunction happening within my team. I don't have a big team. I've got the right amount. We've got 5 or 6 people. No problem.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for some inspiration because the Scrum Guide isn't prescriptive. It just says, look, this is the patterns that you work.
Yeah.
Go forth and do, and you make those patterns fit. So I'm now looking for patterns that fit within an existing framework.
Yeah.
With a small team of people. Mm-hmm. Where do I start from that?
So I would go to XP. I wouldn't even be thinking about Xscale.
Okay.
I mean, Xscale becomes relevant when your small team needs to align with many small teams. So we are attacking problems of scale, but that's the point, is that we're attacking problems, not trying to scale you up. If you can get away with sticking with your small team, your program of work just requires a squad or a scrum, beautiful. If it requires, we need a few teams to coordinate in sort of a work stream or a value stream. Oh, well, now we've got some stuff for you that's going to be directly relevant.
Okay, well, let's step it up then. I'm no longer, I still have my team. We have whatever things that were challenging, but now I'm part of a larger project and my team works with this particular component.
Yeah.
That attaches to this particular component that attaches to this particular component.
Yeah.
And so now I have, by way of organization, for whatever reason, I have some fairly strong silo patterns. Mm-hmm. So I've got these three, four, five teams that I now need to have work towards a common goal to meet the needs of a project. And I am talking, so someone in a more traditional company.
Okay, so.
Does Xscale then come into play?
Yes, and it comes into play by changing your frame the very first instance, because you're talking about scaling up, and that's difficult to do. We'd rather do something that's easy.
So
our idea of descaling, Les talks about descaling. They just don't give you any patterns to do it, so we're very interested in the practice. Descaling, we're not the people who invented that word. In fact, just about none of the words are things that we invented. What we're trying to do is tie these things together in an orderly way. So I guess there's bits and bobs we have. Anyway, so first things first, what about the breadth of the business problem you're trying to solve? The business problem you're trying to solve is usually either there's some sort of risk or there's some sort of bottleneck? And why don't we approach that breath first? Let's understand. Because, you know, when someone says, oh, well, you know, we've decided, we've got a bit of work we're doing and there's a bit more we need to do and this is going to glom on, this is going to glob on. It's a little bit like looking through the wrong end of the telescope. We're trying to describe little bits and pieces of something that we don't really have a clear picture of at this point in time. If we step back and go, well, wait a second, let's understand what kind of a market ecosystem do we have? And it could be internal, that's all right. But if we're going to grow that ecosystem, what's involved? So we immediately start to talk about the pirate metrics. We've got to acquire people into this ecosystem. We have to activate them. And then we have to retain them. We want to get them to refer other people in, not necessarily customers. None of this is necessary about customers. It's mutual benefit. And then return, the original pirate metrics, we talk about revenue. We like to talk about return is the last R in R, because that's the acronym, because reducing risk is a kind of return. Mm-hmm. Learning is a kind of return. So anyway, if we start there, we can build something that we call a pirate canvas. And the reason we're doing this very abstract sounding thing in response to what sounded like a really concrete challenge is we want to make certain we got the frame right. It's very easy to solve the wrong problem. And then you just create an awful lot more. And there's lots of neat examples that I think I have to explain that one. So anyway, that's on frame, but then on change. If we think about, we want to introduce X scale, blah, blah, blah. Well, all right. Let's say we've got an existing team or an existing work stream of teams. And we want these guys to start taking this stuff out. Well, some of them will be really gung-ho. Yay, this is, oh, well, now we're out of the box. We can do all this stuff. And some of them will be resistant. And the ones that are resistant, well, teams can only change at the pace of the most resistant team member because everybody has to maintain trust relationships. Mm-hmm. And then the stream can only change at the pace of the most resistant team and so on. So this idea of pushing change into organizations and working piecemeal at it is, in my experience, not a very good idea. So what we want to do instead is pull the organization into a new capability. So to do this, we first have to go, wait a second, let's just define a mission and build a capability to solve that mission. Rather than trying to start with something existing and push change into it that we hope is going to, let's build a working capability that's going to last. Because that's really the intent. Once we've got that working, then we can put the work on their hopper. And they can then, that's their mission, they're going to go and do that work. And whether that work comes from an existing program or someplace else or a new idea, that's all good. Or even better, a business challenge, and we want to get more throughput in the context of that business challenge. Mm-hmm. So, but that's going back to frame. So what we want to do is we want to cherry pick just the most change champion people, the progressives from the organization, from business, design, delivery, DevOps, just a few people, a dozen people, 20 people. We want to cherry pick them and form a new work stream. Very slender. We call it a steel thread stream. And get it to the point where with metrics, we've proved that it's working. And working is not, oh yeah, everyone's happy. Working is we have business outcomes and they're happening thick and fast. And we're really happy with business throughput. And business throughput, I mean, in the gold rat sense, not in some magic burn up chart sense. Anyway. So once it's working, then we're in a position to grow it. We can split it right down the middle and we can, identify the next most progressive folk in the organization. We use open spaces on usually a couple of months to a 3 month cadence, both to socialize benefits and to build appetite in the rest of the organization, to get involved. And the way that you do this then is all about splitting and doubling. You never disrupt the rest of the organization. You never push change into existing teams and streams. At the same time, you grow your capability at an exponential rate and you deal with change bottlenecks as you go. So you have a much less bumpy ride. I think of it as like a superconductor for change because you never have any resistance. At the end of the day, coming back to your original challenge, how does a Scrum Master do all that?
I probably don't.
Well, depends on whose ears they've got in the organization. You're going to need executive support at some level to be able to kick that off. To give an example of it, I'm being long-winded again. Hang on, I'll give you an example from 2010, but why don't I let you get a word in?
Are you good? Oh, no, I'm quite okay. I was letting you go. So if we're going to look at this, so the Scrum Master might not be the person to do it. You'd need certain conditions for success. What do you see those certain conditions as being?
You have to know what success means to you. So in Xscale, we've got three pattern languages, really. We've got there's a DevOps pattern language that rebases DevOps on XP using something we call the zeroth way of DevOps.
Is this like the Isaac Asimov zeroth law?
Yeah, a little bit. The idea is, Kim's three ways are great, but the zeroth way is to simplify and automate. If you're not doing that, then I don't think you're doing DevOps. You're doing something else. And so basically, simplify and automate, that's to say merciless refactoring. When we look at the first and second and third ways, all of these things were present sometimes in the kernel in XP. It's sort of, that was the birthplace for the CICDD, all of that stuff. We were doing that back in the day. We didn't make a lot of rah-rah about it because we're doing it in the small. We didn't really realize there was going to be a play for this stuff in organizations. And now that we realized it, well, a lot of that stuff, we talked about Yagni, it has a part to play in the way we go about building business agility, which I'll define as the ability to respond to changing market conditions. And I'm defining it that way specifically. I will come back to your question. I'm defining it that way because in last year's State of Agile survey, they had this amazing number. They asked a lot of questions and there was a lot of happy responses. I think 98% of people said they're getting benefit from Agile at a project and a team level. But only 4% said that Agile helps them respond to changing market conditions. Four. And that's after all of the scaling frameworks, all of that stuff. It doesn't really matter what scaling framework you picked. 4% are actually getting the outcome that you would expect any scaling framework would give you, which is why we say scale is a problem. So I'm not knocking them because they all have really useful patterns in them. But we have to approach them in terms of business outcomes first. No, I have forgotten your question. So,
It was the conditions. What conditions
for success?
Preconditions for success.
Okay, so I would say we have to look at those conditions in terms of numbers. So, any transformation program should have some numbers on the outcomes it's intending to achieve. People talk about digital transformations. Well, if a digital transformation didn't improve your business, you wouldn't think it was a success. So why would we think that an agile transformation that doesn't improve your business is a success? When someone says it works, look, we went and did a survey of traffic lights and everyone's coming up green. They're all having a good time. Yeah, well, how's your business? So if we think that value flow is something that's important to us in a lean context,
yeah.
Well, every bit of work we do should increase the rate of value flow you'd expect. So if we took the first derivative of value flow, that ought to be able to reflect an improvement in workflow. And yeah, it's really gross and quantitative, and we need to drive that back to, well, qualitatively what improved that, but still that's what we should see as outcomes. And then realistically, when you learn things, learning things improves the way you work, if they're valuable things to learn. Mm-hmm. And so there ought to be a way to gauge the flow of learning through the organization. People get very excited about continuous improvement. Our team is doing retros with a PDCA Deming cycle. Woohoo! And that's all good. But if those learnings don't flow through the organization, if they're stuck in your little squad, your little scrum, then you're not maximizing the value of the learning. So we should be able to think of learning flow as the second derivative of value flow or of business throughput. And we ought to be able to put those on a nice diagram and see them. And the really weird thing to me, the thing that appalls me after 20 something years in this game, is that when I look around, I see all of these graphs of cumulative flow and burnups and so on. I don't see any graphs of changes to business throughput. We've got two groups of people. We've got product managers and project managers. They both have a piece of throughput. The product managers worry about sales. The project managers worry about operating expense. And we never do the gold wrap thing and go, well, actually, business throughput is net profit plus operating expense minus truly variable costs. We don't, there's no agile graphs that show me that. So part of the motivation in Xscale is to go, let's do this properly, fellas.
So Xscale isn't just the scaling. You just mentioned both project and program management in there. So there's a bunch of tools.
I said product and project. But I mean, product and project. Yeah, because I think project and program are very closely aligned. They're all about cost accounting.
Okay. So there are tools that play into that space then?
Not really.
Okay.
We have to build.
No, that's fine. I was just making sure that...
So, we've got a diagrammatic format we call throughput diagrams. And we're not trying to go, we've got something that's exciting and new. We're trying to say, we've got something that's based on a bunch of really good old ideas, and we just need to make them readily accessible, because what you don't measure, you can't optimize. So if we're trying to get business throughput to improve, and we're not putting it right, fair and square in front of everyone's noses, we've got, well, to use the Australian vernacular, we've got Buckley's. And for those listeners who are not in Australia, there used to be a department store called Buckley's and None. And people would say, you've got two chances, Buckley's and None. So Buckley's basically means no chance.
No chance. Okay, so let's talk about the throughput metrics, the business throughput metrics.
Yeah.
What are those throughput metrics? Now, you mentioned, I think, how learning's distributing through it, but how do you define this?
So once upon a time, I mentioned Gold Rat a couple of times.
I like Gold Rat.
Yeah. So Gold Rat, he produced this beautiful book called The Goal, which basically said, when we're looking at production systems, we should look for the bottleneck, because there's always one constraint that dominates. And any work that we do on any other constraint is wasted work, because it's not going to open the bottleneck, which means that the end-to-end throughput flow isn't going to improve. And there's always a bottleneck. Once you open one, you'll get another. To begin with, we have to think about that in market context. What do market bottlenecks look like? And how do we describe them? And we actually already touched on them. The pirate metrics, if one of those is your bottleneck, then don't work on the others. We have to reprioritize consistently so that we're able to focus our priorities, the priorities of our work, on the bottleneck. So anyway, ask me the question again.
Throughput. We're talking about throughput. We're talking about the metrics. We're talking about what they are. And so Goldratt.
Yeah. Well, so Goldratt, he came up with this idea, and it was a powerful idea. And he would go into factories and he'd go, you see, looking on the factory floor, that machine there, the machine's going chunk. That's the chunking machine. That's your bottleneck. Look, you've got lots and lots of inventory mounting up going into that, and only this little narrow stream of stuff coming out of it. So that's your problem. And the managers go, fantastic. Wow, we never thought of it that way. Thank you, Mr. Goldratt. So what we're going to do is we're going to fire half the people who are feeding parts into that chunking machine. So that way we'll minimize operating expense and maximize utilization. Excellent. And Goldratt would go, no, you buy another chunking machine. And they go, but that wouldn't minimize operating expense. And he went, oh, crikey. Well, he didn't say, oh, crikey, because he wasn't Australian. But anyway, he said, all right, I think we're going to have to change the way we do accounting around here. So he invented this thing called throughput accounting. And he had to basically redefine the basis for understanding success, for understanding progress. And so his idea was that rather than telling managers, you're supposed to maximize sales, if you're a product manager, or you're supposed to minimize operating expense if you're a project manager. What we do is we say to them, or to the management function, if we're going to do self-management, we'll come back to that. Anyway, what we say to them is, well, let's add operating expense and net profit together. And then we'll take, because some parts of operating expense are things we want to minimize. If we think about with everything that comes off the end of the line, every feature we ship in a software sense, every service we provide, whatever it is, that's in terms of giving benefit out of the end of the stream. With every one of those, if we've got expenses that we can reduce there, fantastic. That's what he calls truly variable cost. But the other expenses, those are the things that fund your capability to generate net profit. You actually want to increase those if it's going to increase the sum of operating expense plus net profit minus truly variable cost. Now, this is heresy from the point of view of PMBOK prints to any cost accounting, anything. So I want to give an immediate example to explain where this is important or why it's important. And I want to go back to 2011, Amazon versus Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble is this giant retail bookstore chain in the US. They're in every mall. And they were, when I lived in the US, they were the dominant bookseller. By 2011, they'd had Amazon nipping their heels for a long time, and now it had pulled them down, was biting on their legs. So they were doing their best on the lean front, and they did a heroic job. They slashed everything they could slash. In the 90s, when I used to visit them, there was a beautiful environment. You go in there, there were kids singing, there were plays, there were book readings, book signings. It was a lovely place to relax, not necessarily to buy books, but to relax. Well, by the time we get to this part of the story, everything was slashed to the bone. They're just moving books. That's it. That's what they do. So 2011 was the crossover point where Amazon started selling more than Barnes & Noble. 2011, Barnes & Noble had brought things down to the point where they made $100 million. And these are rough figures. I've got the exact figures if you want. But they made $100 million on 300. So it was net profit, $100 million. On operating expense of 300 mil. Same year, Amazon also made a net profit of 100 million on an operating expense of over $10 billion. They weren't minimizing operating expense. That wasn't their game. And today, Barnes & Noble shares are $6 and Amazon shares are over 2,000. So part of the game here is, it used to be, you'd try to minimize operating expense to increase net profit to give dividends. People don't give a damn about dividends. They care about share prices these days. So if Amazon were issuing dividends, and they weren't increasing their share price, their stockholders would be going, what's going on here? So the whole cost accounting purview is sort of from the 19th century. We want to make profit for our owners. These days, no, we want business report. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
Yep, that does a bit. It's now part of that is also there is a play for something like lean where you're trying to minimize the waste on the way through.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, just out of control expense, operating costs doesn't make a great deal of sense. You want to add operating costs that add you more money.
Absolutely. Truly variable costs, you want to minimize those.
Yes.
Kaizen. Yeah.
100%.
But Lean dropped a couple of words on the ground when it got to Kaizen.
Okay.
Have you heard of Kaikaku and Kakushin?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, so I think most people know Lean came from Toyota Production System.
Yes.
Well, it didn't take everything. Toyota Production System. So Kaizen's all kind of a iterative improvement. Mm-hmm. Merciless and determined, and it's excellent. It's really good at bringing down truly variable costs. But Kaikaku is a step improvement. So let's say that your value stream is bottlenecked. It's constrained.
Okay.
Something. Yeah. So we've got to open that bottleneck. That's Kaikaku. And so it's determined work on opening the bottleneck. That was in TPS. It's just that Well, Taichi Ono wasn't really very interested in being outcompeted. And so if people didn't take it all from him, and he went, oh, gee, that's a shame. I don't know that. But anyway, that's what it looks like. Then Kakushin, the idea is, well, we've got one value stream and it's going off. It's going exponential. It's fantastic. Well, that's when we need to be starting the next one. We need to be taking the profits from one to fund the growth, the initial growth of the other. And this is where, if you look at what Apple did under Jobs, they did such an incredibly good job of that. And it was what Clayton Christensen calls the second horizon. The first horizon is business as usual. Third horizon is innovation, what's going on in your labs. The second horizon is Kakushin, taking your existing stuff and going, great, well, we want to continue the exponential growth. So we're going to need another growth curve starting before this one gets out of its expansion part, because it'll hit some sort of market bottleneck. And so that idea of stacking growth curves is fundamental to what we think of as exponential.
Ah, excellent, excellent. Now, I want to be respectful for your time and to our listeners' time as well. If there was one thing you wanted listeners to take away about xScale, mm-hmm. About the patterns, about where to start, about where to look, about how to think, what would be that nugget of truth that you'd get them to take away with them today?
Jeez, you ask really easy questions. all right. I don't think we've touched on it yet. In xScale Alliance, we have a learning ecosystem, not a training hierarchy. Our idea is Muhin Shu, not Shu Hari. So I go with Muhin Shu as the nugget. And so I guess I better explain it.
You better explain it.
All right. If you ask people where Shu Hari came from, some of them will go, oh, it was martial arts, I think. And some of them will go, I remember Alistair Coburn first started talking about Shu Hari. He'd been talking about some translation of Lao Tzu that some guy named Peter Merrill wrote. And then he started talking about more of the Asian stuff. And then he started talking about Shu Hari. Where'd that come from? Well, Alistair got it from some friends who were into Aikido. But if you look at it, Shu Hari came from the history of tea. It came from tea culture. And if you look at tea, it's all these very stylized, rigid movements these days. It's something, the current tea ceremony is something that could never have produced the innovations that we see in Japanese tea. Japanese tea is completely different to tea everywhere else. Where'd that come from? If you look at the history of it, anyone who's seen The Seven Samurai knows that there was a period of terrible civil war in Japan called the Sengoku period. It was resolved by a change to the way tea is served by a guy named Rikkyu. And Rikkyu's principle was Muhin Shu, not Shu Hari. Shu Hari came like 300 years later. And Muhin Shu means no guest and no host. So we're here together as peers to try and improve the experience of tea. So that was the way Agile worked when I was involved in it in the early days. And it's what was lost when the Agile Industrial Complex started squatting on it and issuing 1 million T-Billion certificates that don't actually make any group of people, because Agile is an aspect of collaboration, of teams, not individuals, don't actually make a difference there. So anyway, and there's a forgetting curve to talk about. There's a lot of things we could talk about there. But a point of Muhin Shu is we're not setting ourselves up as some mighty authorities. What we've got in xScale Alliance is an ecosystem of prominent, seasoned, independent, agile coaches from business agility, product management, DevOps. We don't try to pretend that any of these coaches does all of these things. But more to the point, they all collaborate on building xScale. It's not just the Peter Merrill show. So that's why we say it's the Linux of the Agile world. We're all trying to improve it together. And we do meetings every week. We have a big online conference every month. We call it Global Extreme Tea. And we do this in multiple different time zones. The whole point of what we're doing is to improve the benefits we're bringing to our clients, whether that means improving the training material, whether it means improving the coaching practices, the reward models, the change models, or decision making, you name it. That's what we're about. We're not about saying you have now got the blessing and now go and train people. In fact, we don't even have a training path to get someone from a practitioner to a coach. We hand select these coaches, rather than trying to train them.
Cool. Now we're nearing the end of our time, so we want to give our guests a chance to share any upcoming events or shout outs. So I'm going to let you call it out as you will.
Okay. Let's see. I'll talk about two because I don't want to overload the listener with here's a million different things you can do. The first one is going to be really good fun in August. We have a two-day hackathon coming up we call Code Without Thrones. Now, we've run a series of events called Game Without Thrones over the last 3 years. The idea with Game Without Thrones is we want to get together a decent-sized group of people. The smallest you could do Game Without Thrones would be probably 9 people. You could get away with 6, but 6 would suck. Because you want to see, this is about alignment and autonomy instead of command and control. But this works for up to 162 people. You can get 162 people and in a 2-hour period, get them to build a single Lego castle together, a symmetrical, beautiful castle with no command and control at all, no managers, no masters, no owners, pure metric-driven autonomy and alignment. And we always get a good outcome with this thing. So the biggest we've done so far wasn't 162, it was 110 in Toronto last year. So we went, okay, if we can build Lego this way, let's see if we can build real systems this way. Mm-hmm. So Code Without Thrones, we're still going to be building castles for the first one of these in August. The idea is there's an open source version of Minecraft, the kids game. It's a voxel block building game. So it's not different, not very different to Lego. Mm-hmm. But we're going to try and get 160 people worldwide in different time zones to collaborate on writing code that builds castles in this Minecrafty sort of a world. And if we can do that, well, then we've kind of got lightning in a bottle. And if we can't do it, then we're going to learn some things. So that's why I say learning ecosystem. We're not afraid of failing, and we want to fail fast. This kind of challenge is how we go about it. So anyway, that's one. Second is for folk who are interested in getting involved in Xscale, we run a monthly training series. Actually two of them, one in product management, one in business agility. And these training series run live online in 3-hour chunks. We basically have 6 3-hour sessions, 2 a week for 3 weeks. So that way we do these things after hours in the respective time zones. So you can learn sitting on your couch in your jocks. You can learn from world experts, not from trainers. Learn face-to-face with the people who are actually at the coalface doing this stuff. So if you go to xscalealliance.org, you'll find places where you can find out about that stuff. And if you are so moved, you can book. And if you happen to be a seasoned Agile coach and you'd like to get involved in something that's more like Linux than a cult, a church, a cathedral, then go to the same place and there's contact links there and we'd love to hear from you.
Okay. So lastly, what's the best way for our guests to get in contact with you should they want to do so directly?
So the site I mentioned, xscalealliance.org, that's got lots of ways of getting in touch with yours truly. But on LinkedIn, we have a group called Xscale Alliance. And it's growing very rapidly. We only kicked it off 2 weeks ago, and we've got several hundred in now. And it's a community of interest. So if you want to ask sharp questions and put us on the spot, and if you think that what I'm saying is all nonsense and you want a challenge, and in general, if you want to interact with other people who are interested in trying to take these ideas and use them and improve them and take them away, to where they're working and get benefit, that's a really good place to hang out. So, and all of the Xscale coaches are managers there, so you can interact with all of them, not just me.
Nice. Well, thank you again, Peter, for joining us today and to you, our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review or rating and leave a comment on iTunes. It really does help the show. If this is your first time tuning in, hey, why not subscribe? And if you'd like to join the discussion, your stories, your questions, your community, you can actually find us at coalition.agileuprising.com. Finally, support from listeners like you help cover our hosting and production costs. And you can see the show notes for details on how you can become a Patreon. Until next time, this is Brad from the Agile Uprising podcast signing out.
Thanks, Brad. Hooray.
And cue the music.